Today, on Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast, a conversation with David Chase.
It's really important to stick to your guns, I'll tell you that. But I don't think you can be an out-and-out asshole about it.
With a career spanning more than 30 years in television, David Chase's work as a writer, director, and producer has cut a wide swath, contributing to such shows as The Rockford Files, Northern Exposure, and as creator of HBO's The Sopranos. Portions of today's podcast were recorded at the 7th Annual Austin Film Festival and at the 19th Annual Austin Film Festival. Chase's new film, Not Fade Away, is in theaters now. We begin with a clip recorded way back in the year 2000 and David Chase talking about The Sopranos, which was then in its second season.
At first, my expectations were that we would make the pilots. They wouldn't buy it. If I was lucky, I could persuade them to give us some more money to make a low-budget feature and release it theatrically. Then they bought the pilot, and my expectations were that it would go 13 episodes and out. And by that time, I had other writers with me, and Jim and Edie and Lorraine. None of us figured it would ever happen. While we were doing those 13 episodes, we thought, we're working in Queens in total anonymity, doing this thing and going, we like it, but that probably is a bad sign. I don't know why. It's just the way you feel. You think, this is too much fun. We're having too much fun doing this. This can't go on. In fact, this kind of interesting thing about it was, this is when I knew I was in the right place. It was during the making of the pilot. There was a scene that was written in which they take some guy out and they don't beat him up. It was a guy who was a degenerate gambler who owed the money, and his character Hesh and Pussy take him out to this place and they talk. And I knew about this place called Patterson Falls in New Jersey, and so we decided to set it in this bridge over this river. And at the same time, there was another scene in which Tony had and his mistress were doing something, and in the last minute I thought, let's give him a boat, like a pleasure boat and a yacht. Not a big yacht, but like a cabin cruiser. So we did that, and at that time money was an issue because it was a pilot and they didn't know what was going to happen. Money was very much an issue. And I got a call from Chris Albrecht, and he said, what's going on with this show? It's waterfalls and boats and I said, it's just a better place to shoot it. The waterfalls is more interesting, and it actually makes it dangerous. And he said, what's with the boat? The guy owns a boat, because he's supposed to be a proletarian kind of a gangster. And I said, it's just a boat. Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. He said, now we have to move locations to get this boat in. And I said, it's not that important, but let's just do it. And I hung up the phone, and I realized something great had just happened, because I knew that if I had been talking to a network executive, a regular networker, they would have said, it should be a really big boat, and it should be docked in Vegas on Lake Mead, and that's where he should live, is in the top of a penthouse, on top of the Frontier Hotel or something. And I realized I was in the right place. And strangely enough, that the money issue keeps reminding you what the show should be. And when The Godfather went to the Vatican and all that, it got kind of wacky. When the helicopter is at the top of the hotel, we never want to do that. Well, I'm Italian American, and all of my relatives are mobsters. And comes from a lifetime love of that genre. And we do read things in the paper. We really can't have a consultant. We have talked to a few people who've been in the program. Then you think to yourself, we're talking to a rat. And do you really want to do that? Number one. And who even knows if he's telling you the truth? So we talk to law enforcement people. One of our writers, Frank Renzulli, grew up sort of in a social club in Boston and knew a bunch of people like that. Living in New Jersey, I just remember things that happened there, and it's kind of a pastiche of all that put together. But we really try to make it as realistic as possible in terms of what mob life might be like.
Fast forward to 2012 and David Chase discussing his early work in the 1970s, television legend Stephen Cannell, and The Rockford Files.
I had gone on strike, and I met this guy on the picket line, and we had a good time on the picket line, fooling around and everything. When the strike was over, he got his first producer job. He was hired to be the producer of the back nine of a show called The Magician with Bill Bixby, and so he brought me onto that as a staff writer. And so I was inside the studio gate, and then from that point on, I never stopped working. In fact, he helped me get my first agent, too. I had written a screenplay, which I gave to him, which he gave to his agent, and probably because it was him, he was one of his agent's best client, I think. Hopefully, I think the story surprised him. And I've always had a knack for writing dialogue. At that time, we worked a lot with outside writers. And we were really up against it. We didn't have enough time, and we had nine episodes to do. And we'd get scripts in from freelancers, which always have to be rewritten. Mm-hmm. And that's where I finally learned
how to do it. I mean, cut and paste and cut out this piece of a scene and put it together with that, and then add some dialogue and real veterinarian stuff. At that time, people made the mistake of saying, of when they're trying to plot out the story, they'd say, Rockford wakes up in as a bullet comes through the window of the trailer. Rockford goes outside and he sees the car speeding away. Rockford jumps in his car and he goes after it. Later that day, Rockford is at the bank and he thinks he sees the same car. On and on and on and on. Cannell was the one who taught me to say, even though the writer of that screenplay probably knew who the heavies were, he wouldn't go over there and see them in action. So you never, so but by saying that, what are the heavies doing? You would cut to the heavy. And that did a couple of things. It relieved the boredom of the initial story. And it also showed you these other people, other characters, and these two stories coming together like that, Rockford on his investigation and the heavies on their plan. And it went like that. Sounds pretty simple, but it wasn't. I mean, for me, that was a revelation. It all started with Garner. I mean, the guy is just tremendously magnetic and feels like you might know him, as good looking as he was. He had a down-home quality. And the other thing about it was that based on his own life, Stephen had a very demanding, kind of critical father who was very successful. I think he wanted to come up with a different kind of father for Rockford. And that was the father, the character of Rocky, who was not particularly successful, but just a really sweet guy and really easygoing. And I think that was the key to it. I think that relationship, I think, was the backbone of the show, really. I mean, there was never any mother around or any sisters or cousins or anything like that. Usually, like a lot of TV shows, they bring in the cousins from wherever. But we never did that, and yet it felt like a family. And I really don't want to give myself too much credit for that show. It was his show. I remember my wife and I used to watch when we had no money. You know, we used to watch Medical Center. And we used to, with Chad Everett. Or every other episode, somebody would come to the hospital, and his boss would say to him, Joe, what are you so involved with this case for? He said, because these people brought me up after my parents got killed in the car crash. Or she was the next door neighbor after my parents got killed in the car crash. Blah, 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 blah. All these people from his former life. And I think that was the same thing. I think it was called bad TV to do that. You know, your cousin. I mean, Stephen was very, here's what he did, which no one else was doing, was he talked about the money. Rockford made $200 a day. Guy. No pro bono, no dog run over by the car, nothing like that. No missing babies on the doorstep. They used to try to get us to do that kind of stuff. He never would. It was $200. He always did the right thing, obviously. He was a moral person. But we didn't get him into things because he knew the priest where the little crucifix was missing from or something like that.
Chase discusses a mobster in therapy and pitching Sopranos.
And they said, for example, how would you like to do a show like The Godfather for television? And I said, no, I wouldn't want to do that at all. Because what I was picturing was The Godfather, those old cars and those big overcoats and all that stuff, the Rosati brothers, and that had already been done. And I didn't want to, I said, no, I'm not interested in that at all. Then I was driving home and I remembered this idea I had about a mobster in therapy. So I went back the next day and I told them that, and then we started going around making the rounds at the networks and got a deal and we developed it and blah, 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 blah. We sold it originally to Fox Network. I don't remember whether I had already done a lot of work on it. I think I had a kind of a storyline already. Fox really liked it. I remember that. We walked out of the room and everybody's on cloud nine. And then February or March came around when they pick up the shows, and I wasn't hearing anything about it. And they were so high on it. This is one of our big things, and I wasn't hearing anything. But then I got a phone call from an executive there, and she said, listen, this is the time when we're about to make our choices, and I just want you to know before all that happens that as a human being, I really like your script. And I thought, oh. Okay. So I said, well, when are we going to get started? Well, now, that, I don't know about that. We have to, number one, figure out our budget. We got to do this. And frankly, we have to figure out, do we want to do a show about a mob family? Now they get the idea. Yeah. And it turns out they didn't. So, which was a blessing in disguise. So then we took it to all the other networks, and we got the same runaround there at all those places. They loved the writing, but they were scared of it. And by that time, 2 years went by, and we went back to HBO. We went to HBO with the script. They could read the script and tell whether they wanted to do it or not. And in fact, I believe they said they told Brad Gray they were interested in the concept. Brad described it, and I said, let me do a rewrite on this thing before they read it. Because in the first version, nobody got murdered in the Fox version. No one got killed.
I thought, Network.
Network. It was partly network. It was also a desire on my part to try to be more realistic. I mean, people don't get murdered every day in organized crime. But then I thought, but as a movie, this isn't a documentary. As a movie, you better have that in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I rewrote it, and we gave it to HBO, and they said they wanted to do it.
David Chase talks about the inspiration for The Sopranos and two powerful cast members.
The inspiration for that show was that my mother was a difficult personality, and she was pretty much like the woman on the show that you saw if you watched the show.
Yes.
And my wife used to tell me all the time, you got to do a show about her. She's hysterically funny. And she really was. She was famous in our family for being outrageous and inappropriate and having boundary issues. And whenever we would go back east to hang out, my cousins and my aunts would corner us in a room and say, "Ooh, Norma did this, and then she did that, and then she came down here." For example, one time I was at home, and she said, we were going to my cousin's house. She said, "I have to bring them this milk. I don't want it to go bad." So we had to bring this milk and a bunch of other crap. And we went down there, and we get to the garage, and the milk falls out, or in the kitchen, on the floor of my cousin's house and breaks. And the milk already was bad. So she was just trying to get rid of something that was a problem for her, and she didn't care how inconvenient it was for anybody else, and created a bigger problem for my cousin. So this is just one small example. So, but those kind of things, my wife used to say, you got to write about her. She's incredible. But even sometimes, I remember one time my mother was making some veal cutlets, and she was holding a platter in one hand, and she was to put the veal cutlets in as they come out, this big platter, ceramic platter. And I said something to her, and she started banging on the platter with the fork, going, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know. Until a piece of chip fell off the platter, and she kept right on going until she just had this little one like shard in her hand. So I knew that. And I remember watching that. I was probably like 11, or thought, "What the fuck?" Yeah, this is, so I knew there was stuff to be mined there. But when I was going through it, normally. Right. It was very distressing. It was preventing me from doing what I wanted to do. It was, you know, the same old stuff over and over again. So I didn't take it funny. I didn't take it as amusing at the time. I ate for free for a long time, telling stories on my mother. You know, I really did. You know, or you get to with people and you start talking about your mother, and I could always like trump the house. I was working on a show that I created, a show called Almost Grown, and I was telling people about her. And somebody on that show said, you should write a thing about a TV producer and his mother. And I thought to myself, who would be interested in that? A TV producer that's not a very sympathetic character. Yeah, I remember my mother, when I first directed a show, I directed Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And I called her up and I said, well, I'm directing, I directed my first episode. She said, did they accept it? So I was trying to break out of the TV business, and I thought, what would make a movie? And I thought, maybe if the guy wasn't a TV producer, but was a mid-level mobster, he'd be a tough guy, he'd be a killer, he'd be all those things, and yet he'd be the victim of his own mother. As soon as we got in business with casting, with Walken and Jaffe, who were our casting people, they started saying, Jim Gandolfini, Jim Gandolfini, Jim Gandolfini. And I said, who's that? And also, but then I remembered him from the Elmore Leonard book was Get Shorty. And he did come in to read, and he stopped in the middle of it and left. And then he was supposed to come in 3 days later, and the word came back that his mother was very ill and had died. It turned out she had died long before that. But and then finally, there was this dance for a long time. It's funny because he's not self-protective at all as an actor. In other words, by that I mean, he'll do anything. A lot of people will say to you, I won't do that, or I won't take my clothes off in that situation, mm-hmm. or no, you're not going to show me masturbating, are you crazy? Mm-hmm. Or no, mm-hmm. never, he'll go for it. Mm-hmm. He may not like it, but he'll do it. But he, for some reason, got concerned about when the time comes to actually do it, the first day of shooting for any given season, for example, his nerves going to get the best of him a little bit. And so he finally came to my house, and we put him on tape there, and he was great, and that was that. We probably saw 300 women for that role, and none of them even close, as far as I was concerned. They were all doing this crazy Italian mama thing that wasn't what it was, you know. Oh, my God, what are you doing? All that kind of stuff, you know. And I thought, boy, we're dead in the water. We're going to start to shoot, like, in a week. And then Nancy Marchand came up the stairs to the casting office, all out of breath, and this very regal sort of waspy woman, and just did it and just channeled that thing, and it was, and there was no discussion. I mean, you don't even have to say, well, is she the one or is she not the one? It was just, every time it's there. That happens to me every time I cast with every role.
I think to myself, we're dead in the water here. We're not going to have the right person. We don't have it. And sooner or later, somebody comes in who was made for it. And now, you know, probably now it'll probably have that problem, but that I've said this. But it happens every time. But it's a white knuckle situation.
David Chase closes discussing rock and roll, writing visually, and sticking to your guns.
Rock and roll was all I cared about, and it taught me everything. I went to college, and I studied American literature and this and that and the other thing, but I learned more from Aftermath, the Stones album, than I did from, maybe I shouldn't admit this, than I did from Elizabeth Barrett Browning. After those skinny giants arrived here from England and that other skinny giant came from Minnesota, this is about 1964 or so, pop music became a serious, strangely enough, this youth music became a serious adult undertaking. Sex and death and alienation and work, all of it crept in there and it became an art. I knew art from going to the museums in New York and seeing Jorge de Ribera and Manet and all that and thinking, well, that has nothing, I mean, I loved it, but that has nothing to do with me. But what happened between like any given Stones album or Beatles album was unbelievable, how everything progressed. The difference between, let's say, Rubber Soul and Revolver was a miracle. And you knew something, this great art form was being invented. And I've always been struck by the fact that a music whose roots are in the despair of the Mississippi Delta can make you feel so good. This is the walking miracle of this whole thing, and that's why this movie exists.
If the moment is really important, it's up to you to convey what that moment will look like on the screen. It's up to you to convey what that moment will look and feel like in print, with words. That's the whole job, really. Well, you learn, for example, pretty quickly, don't sit every scene around a table with four people talking, sitting down and talking. It's a movie. People should be moving. That took me a long time to learn that, because I like to write dialogue, and I didn't really care whether they were sitting down. But then after a while, you come onto that. And you know, it's a movie. And so if somebody's going to lose their dog, it's probably better off they lose it on the cable car, you know, going up the mountain to San Bernardino or something like that than in their backyard. It's really important to stick to your guns, I'll tell you that. But I don't think you can be an out-and-out asshole about it. I don't think that usually doesn't get you anywhere. If you're difficult, they'll get rid of you. They just won't bother with the problem. Because probably your idea or anybody's idea isn't that great that they have to have it, you know? It just takes all your life skills. It's really, in a way, it's the easiest thing in the world to do, but it's very difficult, but there's no magic formula at all. Just all your life skills of dealing with people.
Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast is brought to you by Austin Film Festival. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan. Today's podcast was produced and edited by Brian Ramos. For more information on the podcast, On Story, the television show, and Austin Film Festival, go to www.onstory.tv or www.austinfilmfestival.com.